This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat.
I'm Vizla Kumarisan.
And you're listening to Digital Desires, the show that explores how screen culture is changing human interaction. This week, we shall talk about the rather interesting developments around the Parkland, Florida high school shooting, also known as the Stoneman Douglas high school shooting, and the aftermath, right? Particularly how social media has become this platform to galvanize a critique or a broader discussion around gun control.
Yeah, I think our attention first got piqued because a lot of the students were uploading images of the aftermath on Snapchat.
Yes.
And we started discussing about how a lot of the grieving is happening through social media.
Yeah.
And then that shifted very quickly to activism.
Correct.
And what we saw in the aftermath within a couple of days of the Parkland shooting was that the students were actually coming together to both as a group and as individuals to speak up against gun violence and for gun control, and even taking on world leaders.
I think
people were responding to tweets by Donald Trump, and then eventually it's now taken on the massive, very powerful National Rifle Association.
Correct. So as of yesterday, there have been demonstrations outside the NRA, the National Rifle Association's office, and more demonstrations are expected. Not only that, the students have had an audience with Marco Rubio.
Yes, there was a town hall that was called last week.
Correct. And that went viral as well. So it's unmistakable that social media has played a role in this regard, especially Twitter. You seem very sanguine about this. You think this is a positive development, Vizla?
I do.
Okay.
Firstly, you know, it was very inspiring. After the tragedy, the shock of another shooting.
It's
in the
worst
US.
High school shooting now. It's worse than Columbine.
It's worse than Columbine. Yeah. It's 17 people dead. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, reading all that happened, some people thought it was a drill. Mm-hmm. And so they thought the students were all acting, and they didn't realize they were actually climbing over actual dead bodies, and were touching real blood.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them saw and crawled over their friends, their teachers who had died. And then, of course, there were fantastic tales of heroism as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there was the track teacher who stood in front of his students and took all the bullets.
Right.
So in the face of all this tragedy, it was really shocking. And then after that unfolded, this very impressive, I thought, very mature response from a lot of the 17-year-old students. Mm-hmm. Now, let's remember that they are, I think, all 17-year-old.
In high school.
And some of them are 18, but most of them 17.
Yeah.
And how on Twitter they started responding to a lot of, like I said, the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
They were responding to Donald Trump's tweets about this. They were responding to the various senators who were actually reluctant to speak up against gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And what usually happens in the aftermath of this kind of gun shooting is that a lot of pundits will say it's too early to talk about it.
Yep.
While the students were saying, no, it's not.
Yep.
And the students were also talking about how it was important for them as children to access their right to education. You know, and that wasn't a very important, I thought that was a really clever way to draw attention to the issue as well.
Right.
You know, the Western world is very, very interested in education in the Global South, for example, right to education. And to portray this discussion within that right to education dialogue, I thought was very, very interesting and very smart.
So don't make it just about guns, but about, you know, what it means to have a good education.
Exactly.
Right? What it means to access it in
exactly.
a safe way.
Exactly. Right. And then in how they really utilize social media. So the teachers were putting up videos of themselves on Facebook, on Twitter, asking for more funding so they can have smaller classes instead of what has now become the popular suggestion, to arm teachers. So it started with the students. Now the teachers are speaking up. There were the viral videos when there was the memorial for the students. The young student, Emma Gonzalez, her speech, I think that went viral.
Right, right.
And after that, all these young leaders emerging who are speaking for the students, encouraging others to speak, who were holding their senators accountable at the town hall, with Marco Rubio, for example, the sheriff, even taking on the president of the NRA.
Right. So it's created this massive ripple effect, right? And I think it touches on two aspects of a common theme that we've talked about on the show, and that is the power of social media mm-hmm. to impact change. And I think for a long time we've been cynical, but I think in this case, it's generated very significant debate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I think the students are also very, very clever, because mm-hmm. it's not something that is in the heat of the moment and people are all responding. I mean, if you've listened to some of the students speak, they are actually thinking ahead.
Correct.
A lot of them are pre-registering because they're going to be old enough to vote. Mm-hmm. And they're already planning. They're already acting. Like, they've got lists of senators who support gun control and who they should vote for and who they should vote against and who they should vote out. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of thinking that's going around this issue as well. It's not just a reaction.
Right. And I do recall every time something like this breaks in the news about how significant, whether symbolically or even in the everyday sense of American life, the right to gun ownership is. Mm. Right. So I lived there for 8 years, and it wasn't uncommon that somebody would have a revolver at home. Right. Now, the debate has kind of splintered to different aspects of gun ownership, so to whether, background checks should be allowed, or even AR-15s, which are assault rifles, should be just available for general consumption. And, you can buy an AR-15
I'm
like
not
you
familiar
buy a cupcake.
With it. Bump stock? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, so bump stocks apparently allow for, like, faster, more regular rounds, right, than as a normal rifle would. And the principle of it is quite interesting. So I remember having a lot of arguments about this with my American friends. And they keep coming back to the fact that the original intention of the Second Amendment was to ensure that you can protect yourself from the government. So the impulse is that the government should not be stronger than the people, right? Therefore, the people should have access to the same weaponry that the government does. Obviously, that never happens, right? But we're pretty much left to the mercies of the state, and the state is pretty much legitimate violence, right? So they have the right to exercise violence upon you based on laws, and laws are socially constructed, blah, blah. So it actually comes out of a very interesting critique of the state, you know? So so they see it as a very, very core aspect of
democracy.
Practice, right? So unfortunately, of course, the discussions don't go there. But I do want to contextualize, why is it that people feel so strongly about positions on gun ownership? Most people in other parts of the world don't really have a position on that, right? Because it's not part of the way in which they think of politics. But there, it strikes a chord each time, because so much of American identity is tied to that. Yeah.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I think, there's been a lot of discussion around how this is also amplified by the divisions in American society. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's also very clear that a lot of the a lot of the protests have not been about banning guns, mm-hmm. but has been for gun control.
Right.
And I think a lot of the young people as well have been very clear to articulate this. While some are questioning the very need to own guns, they're mm-hmm. even questioning the legitimacy of the Second Amendment, the history of it, why it came about and things like that. But most people, I think, are calling for tighter gun controls.
Right.
Or at least some kind of age limit before you can buy guns.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, I don't know. I don't know if I have a stand on this.
Yeah, I don't. I don't feel that strongly about it,
Yeah.
So it is more of an intellectual exercise than anything else. Social media also features in a different register in the discussion, in that Nicholas Cruz, the shooter, and he's apparently confessed to it, gave warnings online. So he had posts about what he was going to do. He kept joking about how when he wants to grow up, he just wants to be a professional school shooter. So the signs were there, but I think locating it online or encountering it online gives it an air of, people might not take it so seriously because it's just another Facebook post. So another part of the debate has raised the question of how seriously we should take those claims, right? And I'm guilty of this as well, because so much of my attitude towards these sort of confessional moments online is cynical, right? That people just want attention, they're not quite serious. But in this case, you do encounter that moment where this guy was actually developing a deeper thought process on whether or not to do it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you make of that?
Yeah, this emerged after the shooting, right? Mm-hmm. Where the FBI actually confessed that they did have Nicholas Cruz on their radar. But for some reason or another, there was no follow-up, there was no enforcement of the usual sort of responses when there's a threat like this that's been made public. But we know for a fact that there is a system in place to monitor, to enforce mm-hmm. certain elements of the law right. when such threats are made.
Right.
Right. So this, I don't think it's so much the failure of social media,
right.
but I think it's the human failure
yeah.
Where enforcement wasn't perhaps sensitive enough or yeah. quick enough in responding.
I don't necessarily think it's a failure of social media, but it does raise the question of that paradox that we all encounter, right? On one hand, social media is, you know, a place where you would, you know, browse funny cat videos or memes alongside these really powerful confessions, right? So it's this, it takes a little bit of mental, emotional adjustment to really engage with these moments, different moments in different ways, right? But on the other hand, there are human beings behind the screen trying to communicate something. And we talked about loneliness and isolation, which is what Nicholas Cruz obviously was going through, right? And obviously, unfortunately, he took it in a violent route.
Yeah.
But it stems from, again, that sense of alienation or a kind of virtual community. And it's weird emotional mazes, right?
But I'm also wondering now, who are his Facebook friends? Because judging from what the students have been talking about him, he didn't have many friends in school. So I, you know, I do wonder who, if he made those posts,
yeah.
who were the ones reading
yeah.
and who was watching? Because apparently he made some videos and posted pictures as well.
Right.
And
maybe that's the problem. Nobody was watching, right? I think, you know, I'm not justifying what he did. Obviously, he was a monster. But there is something about the isolation of, you know, coming of age as a teenager, what more in a very hyper-commercial, hyper-competitive context like American education system, right? That does marginalize a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
People who don't
actually
look a certain way, who are not as, you know, as aesthetically appealing, blah, 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 right?
So actually, people were watching. And I think it was people who had more, you know, marginalized views of society.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, a lot of his Facebook friends were alt-right, as
right.
it's called,
right.
and white supremacists
mm-hmm.
who might have egged him on. I mean, we don't know. I mean,
right.
we have no idea, right? And why he even, how he even developed this language. There's also that paradox.
Yeah.
People were watching, but it was what the people were doing after watching or reading that.
Yeah.
And in this situation, I think they either might have encouraged it
yeah.
or for them it was just something everybody in this particular group says.
Yeah,
so,
and it's not the first time. In Dylan Roof, who shot a church, was young as well. I think he
correct.
Was 19 or something like that.
Yes.
So, and this signals a lot of the anxieties of the future of the young white male, right? That is obviously under attack now. Or they think they are, they believe that they are, and this is how, this is the only way they can express themselves, and violence being such a part of the American formation is encapsulated in these moments, right? The country is no longer for their taking, and Trump is as much a symptom more than the solution, right? A symptom of the problem. And this mutates into this random senseless act of violence, unfortunately. Yeah.
Mm.
So let's take a break and unpack more of the social media progress that's been made, or rather political progress that's been made on social media after the Parkland High School shooting. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Vizla Kumarisan, and this is Digital Desires on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Vizla Kumarisan, and this is Digital Desires, the show that explores our screen cultures, changing human interaction, and we are talking about how social media has become a tool of activism in in the rare instance where it's actually been making a lot of impact, the highest level of power, because the victims, survivors rather, of the shooting is galvanizing a very effective campaign to spark more critical debate on gun control and Second Amendment and the right to education. And this is something we've never seen before, at least the magnitude.
Yes. So when we start talking about Fuad, I think you were a bit cynical.
Yeah, I still am, actually.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's hear why do you feel this way?
Well, there's been a lot of criticisms from the Root, Ebony, OK Player that points this to a largely white phenomenon. So this is a white... it's not social media so much as a largely privileged white voice coming out of a certain demographic, right? Of course, Florida is a huge Cuban, Caribbean, Latino population, right? But a lot of them too, I mean, a lot of the Cuban exiles that went to Florida are whites, right? So whereas they point out to Trayvon Martin, Freddie Gray, Oscar Grant, who were actually young black men who were victims of gun violence as well, and how Black Lives Matter have also been calling for the same sort of attention and care towards how, you know, guns are easily accessible in their neighborhood, how this has created a whole culture of violence. But of course, the same sort of care were not directed to them,
yes,
right? So I'm not taking anything away from the Parkland campaign.
No.
Right? But there, it's not so much a social media thing, but a privileged thing, right? That's seeing the resonance of the agenda. Yeah.
I think last week, the Clooneys, George and Amal, I think, have donated something like 500,000 or 200,000 to the Parkland sort of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Lives Matter and other critiques were quick to point out that Black Lives Matter has called for the same kinds of gun controls, the same kind of efforts, but have received less attention, less glamour.
Less glamour. And even, I mean, if you take a look at what celebrities have done to echo the Black Lives Matter sentiment, right? Colin Kaepernick, for example. He lost his job, basically.
Yes.
Right? But so there you have this very strong contrast. And one would say, well, I don't want to be too cynical and say maybe the fact that it happens in a school, right? It's this universally recognized place where it should be a safe space to the extent possible. Right,
so it's basically about the right to education.
The right to education. So the ideal, you know, of America being a beacon for progress where education is so central is shattered. You know, maybe this makes the Parkland context a bit different than, say, Black Lives Matter. But again, the urban centered activism that has seen more of these same concerns about guns echoed like decades earlier says, well, it's been happening to our schools since forever, but why couldn't we get the Congress or a congressman to listen to us for 2 hours? Why were our pain not granted the same sort of value? So again, not taking anything away from the Parkland context, but I do feel that my cynicism is sort of warranted in that, again, this is a color thing more than a social media thing.
I see your argument. I mean, I see how this whole issue, maybe because it's children,
mm-hmm,
right, is quote unquote safe compared to, say, an issue about race,
mm-hmm,
which is very, very heated, very political.
But the point is that Trayvon Martin was a teenager too. Right?
Yes,
so
he
a lot
was.
Of victims,
correct.
Yeah. Oscar Grant was 21.
So, yeah. So a lot of this is happening in that race discourse in America, which is a bit, I won't say a bit, it's very complex and very complicated, and a lot of people shy away from it and even shy away from taking a position on it. Whereas with this one, it is, like I said, it's about children. And also, I think with that, you can also couch it in very universal terms, because it's not just white children dying.
Right.
It's also black children, Latino children. You know, any child is a potential victim in a situation like this. So, I mean, yeah, I am a bit critical about this as well, especially the attention it's getting. But in that sense, I can see how this has got a more universal appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It is, like I said, quote unquote, a safer way to talk about gun control and violence in American society compared to, say, you know, the issue of race, which is fraught with 200 years of horrible history.
And I do wonder, too, if social media is still a largely white space, not in terms of crude numbers, right? But just in terms of what questions get extended and what doesn't, you know, or what sorts of discussions are more gather a longer lifespan than and not, right?
Yeah.
So I do. It makes me wonder about that, you know, and whiteness has maintained such a long lasting power and emotional hegemony, right? Not just through popular culture, but also economically, right? Through colonialism, imperialism, and it has for the longest time dominated media too, and social media being still centered in the global north, right, has its cultural presumptions as well, right? And for right or wrong, right? So lots of they're not all bad too, you know. So there's a criticism, parallel criticism about Me Too being largely a celebrity white privileged woman's thing. But obviously that opens the doors for other women to also you know, reach out and try to make their narratives resonate as well. So but it does raise a question of what other political options are silenced or muted, not because there's this evil person deliberately kind of, you know, mixing the channels or whatever, but just because, by and large, social media already presumes certain kind of cultural codes, you know. So, yeah, I mean, there are very interesting debates about all sorts of things that do not get that sort of attention.
For example, you know? I think you and I were talking about the unfolding crisis or scandal about Oxfam in Haiti.
Ah, yeah.
Which didn't get as much social media traction. It's then mainstream media.
But it's a bit more complicated.
It's a lot more complicated.
It's harder to kind of reduce to a soundbite, right?
Exactly. Whereas with this one, you do see it easier to... Number one, it's very easy to identify who the victims really are. You know, with the whole, for example, the whole scandal around donor organizations or aid organizations. It's very hard.
Very complicated.
Very complicated. Who is the victim here? Why is it wrong? It's very hard to articulate that without going into nuances of power and influence and patriarchy and things like that.
There's a whole other line of debate about the ethics of prostitution, right?
Exactly. So, and so how do you discuss this while also not condemning prostitution, for sex work, for example? So that makes it a bit more complicated, right? Whereas with this one, it's 280 characters or less.
Yes.
Very easy, right? A quick video, very easy, right? It's great to just capture sound bites on CNN or the town hall with Marco Rubio and to sell it, to market it.
Yeah.
So it's also a very brand-worthy sort of, to just, again, add a bit more cynical tone, a bit more brand-worthy compared to other issues.
Yeah,
and this is something I think the language has existed in America for a long time because it's not the first shooting, neither is it the fifth or the tenth. This is the, I don't know how many it's shooting.
Yeah.
And the discourse around it already exists. There's already been, there's already a thriving national debate about this.
Yes.
So it's easy to pick up the language. It's easy to, no one's starting dialogues. People are continuing dialogues. All right. So it's a very different kind of platform.
Yeah. And on that note, I wonder if, you know, the fact that it's such an easy topic to kind of summarize, and rightly so, because it touches on education, right? If that, the sort of spurt of interest is sustainable, right? Because, you know, there are many other sound bites that emerge in our sort of news attention, you know, and as we've seen in many cases before, a lot of these things come and go, right? So, right now, it's really impressive. I don't think we've seen a bigger social media mobilized kind of cause as we're seeing today. Of course, the Egyptian revolution, Tahrir Square, is a totally different thing,
it's
right?
Different,
but that's an anomaly, right? But insofar as teenagers are leading the initiative and showing a different side of social media use than what we normally associate with millennials, right? This is definitely a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
But the staying power, right? How much longer can this go on is a question mark for me.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to go on like this. I mean, like any movement, it will grow, it will mature. And this is just the starting. You know, like, you know, the kids already have a plan. They want to vote. Some of them are already talking about...
Yeah, but I had plans at 18 too, you know? And all of them are materialized. Thank God. But
Yeah, but you weren't spurned by your fear for life.
No, that's true too. Yeah.
The these are kids. These are children who thought they were going to die. So
definitely.
It's a very different kind of impetus, right? And they've already planned. Some of them are already planning to run run for Congress, for example. Mm-hmm. They're already running, planning to run for local office.
Yeah.
So these are children who are actually thinking ahead, who are going to carry the movement for gun control mm-hmm. forward. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in this form. I think we do the movement a huge disservice by limiting it to just, it has to carry on from here. It will grow, it will expand to what, extent.
Right,
we'll have to wait and see. But I think if it remains like this, it's going to be a bit of a failure. I hope it gets into something bigger.
Yeah.
And it already has made an impact because there's been so much social pressure on so many businesses and stopped support for the NRA.
Yeah.
I didn't know some of these businesses supported the NRA.
Me neither, actually.
It was shocking.
Like basic stuff like rent, car rental services, you know, apparently have deals with the NRA. So
and,
that was
you know, like discounts just to attend NRA conventions, things like that. So, you know, people are already utilizing their power, you know, social media, their purchasing power to exert this kind of influence.
That's true.
But we also have to be fair that, you know, the NRA is, like, you know, it's this huge, rich, powerful organization. Mm-hmm. And these are a bunch of kids who are mobilizing. We also should be very fair and not expecting too much. Mm-hmm. Countless presidents have tried to, you know, to do this
That's true.
They couldn't.
Yeah.
Not countless, a few lah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So we should also cut the kids some slack.
Yeah.
They've also influenced and inspired others. So it's not just students. Teachers are marching as well, mm-hmm. right? And people are speaking up, and that's always a good thing. And, you know.
And I do think that there's a lot more, there's a different kind of pressure that comes from below, from society, than, say, the kind of pressure that one congressman maybe just can't muster. You know what I mean? Because once you're in the system, you are one lawmaker against a few hundred others, you know, and that may not be more valuable, probably isn't, than, say, just a constant a force of anger and indignation online, you know. So that brings a different, more palpable dimension to the sentiment than, say, just somebody pushing, trying to push legislation, you know. So, I mean, Obama did something too, and he was critiqued against it, and the support he had was not vociferous like this, you know. I wonder too if there are lawmakers who are going to use this occasion, you know, given that the time is ripe to push the necessary legislation and caution. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, any concluding thoughts, Rizla, about this?
Well, firstly, you know, I like how this whole movement that has developed from Parkland, with this young being led by young people, gives us pause to stop criticizing millennials and, you know, to just assume that these are a privileged bunch of people. They are facing, you know, the kinds of threats that you and I never faced when we were growing up for it. And it's very inspiring to see that they are taking things up themselves and moving forward themselves and really calling for action.
Yeah.
And then they are showing that they are a force to be reckoned with. They are using their voices very cleverly, very intelligent. And I'm very inspired and I'm very moved. And I really do hope to see more young people speak up like this.
Yeah. And no, I think the gains have been significant and they're nothing to ignore. But it does raise other questions, you know, in relation to the power of social media, you know, and what is visible, what becomes rendered invisible. And it's a chance to, I think, engage these platforms more critically and be aware of the kinds of things that are assumed in these spaces, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But we'll see. I mean, if this keeps going on, we can do a follow-up discussion as well to kind of see, you know, how it's materialized in time.
And, you know, on that note, I think we'd like to think that the internet, social media is this, you know, utopia where there's equality, but it isn't.
Yeah,
we really do see the kinds of norms that dictate our everyday life, so the kinds of power and privileges at play that actually extend into the digital world as well.
Yeah.
So while I am excited, I am also not uncritical about it.
For sure. All right, you can email the show too. Just type Digital Desires on the search space. You'll find the Facebook page. Email biggerpicture@bfm.my as well if you want to chime in. Always keen to hear what you have to say or ask about some of the things we've raised. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Vizla Kumarisan, and this is Digital Desires on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.